Hi, I want to welcome everyone here. My name is Victoria. And I'm Bill Starr. So I know he was special to a lot of people. We have Tim up here is actually going to, if everyone's willing, to record the stories that you might have of my dad. You know, one of his media in art was about sound, so I'd like to have everyone maybe come up with a funny story or a good story or an inspiring story about him that we can record and that people will be able to listen to in the future about him. I've noticed that I've looked at postings on Facebook and I've been very interested in a lot of the things that people had to say. I think it was really good to be able to listen to that. This is really going to be somewhat of a more open format. Brad's going to discuss it a little bit. We've got some of his work on the back behind there. I know that there was a poem that he used to give. We've actually got copies of the poem up here that if someone wants to take a copy, they can go take. There is another story he wrote. Actually, it was a complaint letter to Coca-Cola. Which is, between that and the response he got back from Coke, it's 13 pages long. Typed, single spaced, I think. But it's actually a pretty interesting story if you haven't heard about his issues with Tab, which is what he used to drink before his caffeine-free Diet Coke, which, of course, we have some here. If you're not aware, my dad is up here on the table with his sailing hat. And, of course, a pair of black pants and a black shirt. I will say he was cremated with a pair of black pants and black shirt. So he's got something to wear as he goes out there. So I want to thank everyone again. We've got some munchies and things like that. Again, sort of an open forum. People want to come up and start talking and getting recorded. Please do. I really appreciate that.
Hey, everybody, I'm Brad. I guess most of you guys know who I am, and for those that don't, I met Bill back in 1981. I'm the hairy one on the right over here in the red. I was taken back here in that corner in 1983. Yeah, I was 24 years old. And as Bill has so affectionately reminded me this last year, I met him when I was 22. And he used to laughingly tell me, he says, "You're a 22-year-old snot-nosed kid. Growing old sucks." That's part of his humor that he's had for all these years that we got to know each other. He was a very special person to me in the respect that Bill taught me how to be friends by being my friend. Something I didn't know. My dad's retired army, so I grew up and I moved so many times that there was no sense of making friends, so I didn't do it. And to give you a little bit of an example of how we really got close, Bill sat over there drinking his tab, smoking his cigarettes, and spouting his words of wisdom. But in those days, his words of wisdom was very angry. He was a very angry person back then. But he still had wisdom. And I used to sit downstairs with some old-timers. They were considered the spiritual gurus of Napa. And they used to laugh and tease and joke about him behind his back. Here's this intellectual, really smart guy, thinks he knows all this stuff, and look at where he's at. Well, in the big book, there's a reference to a book by William James. And these guys had been reading it, trying to figure out what it said and what it meant, and they couldn't do it. And one day, Bill walks in, and they said, "Okay, let's see if we can get old smarty pants over there to figure this one out and tell us." And I'm sitting there, and Bill doesn't know this. So they call him over. "Would you read this book and help us to understand this?" And Bill's like, "Sure, fine, yeah, no problem." He took it home, brought it home the next day. "So you guys ready?" And explain this book to them in their terms. And all of a sudden, these old-timers just kind of looked at each other and went, "Oh my God, he's for real." Well, at that time period also, he intimidated me. His intelligence intimidated me. I came in here with an 8th grade reading education. I was a very lost 22-year-old kid when I got here. But all of a sudden, at this time period, I see these guys that was joking and playing a practical joke on him. had the joke turned around at him, and it's like, wait a minute, that's the guy I want to go talk to. And one of the things that he did for me was very, very, very life-changing. He helped to teach me that my feelings didn't have to ruin me. He never once judged me for how I felt. It was all about, hey, we're here because we have our problems. It's okay, no matter what. And that's not who I was when I got here.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. And my phone's beeping at me. There's going to be quite a few things that I'm hoping that people will share with their experiences with Bill. I can sit here and I can talk for 4 hours. I love the man dearly. I had somebody look at me the other day and said, well, it's like your father died. I said, no, this is my brother. I mean, for 36 years, him and I grew closer and closer and closer. One of the things that was interesting in our relationship together is we used to talk. See, he didn't believe that he deserved the admiration that people used to give him. I've done nothing to deserve it. And I kept trying to tell him, says, deserve has nothing to do with it. It's how you treat people. It's how you behave. And he just didn't get that. He just didn't. And I kept trying to explain to him for years what he meant. And I could never put words to it. And I was telling Victoria that it was after he passed that words came to me. I don't write very often. But after he passed, I was writing. I needed an outlet. And it occurred to me, here's this man that was quite an artist in many different forms of media. And I not only watched it, I helped to share in some of it. Some of his early experimental sound work I was involved with at his home. And it occurred to me that, you know, the greatest media that Bill Nolan had was the human soul. And he didn't see it. And it wasn't until afterwards that it really even occurred to me just how much he touched all of us. Not just in these rooms, but out there. It was amazing. You know, if there was one person in the world that I wanted to emulate, it was Bill. And I did, and still try to do as much as I can with that. Because he was absolutely amazing in many ways. Now, he was also human. but he was amazing. This open format is kind of along the lines of, hey, when you want to share something or experience or et cetera, and come on, share it, let us know. Because I'm sure there's going to be a room full of it. I can't think of anything or see anybody in here that doesn't have an experience with Bill. And I was asked by somebody through Facebook Messenger if they could do something. That Bill had written this poem that meant a lot to her. She wanted to do it. And I said, fine. Now, I had talked to a couple of entertainers because Bill knew a couple of entertainers. And I wanted to leave the door open to where if they wanted to do what they could, but the entertainers couldn't get here. And no, I won't get into that. It gets into their anonymity, which is something that Bill taught me how to respect. But I understand the story of this point. There is a story behind it. In 1984, Bill was going to celebrate his 4th year anniversary here at NAMA. And there's this Catholic priest by the name of Father Noel. And Father Noel used to give a talk on spirituality. Now imagine a Catholic priest doing a talk on spirituality. You know, most people that I knew of did not really want to hear such a thing when I got here. But Father Noel said he would do it, and he would happily do it. The word got out. Now imagine this room, and this room is standing room only, packed tight of people of all different religions, all different faiths. Some of them agnostic, some atheists that I knew, to hear this talk. And it was absolutely, it was inspiring, because this Catholic priest took an hour, never once mentioned religion, not once. It changed my life. It bothered Bill. Bill had an issue with spirituality in this program, and it bothered him. And he went several days and could not sleep.
Now, Bill always had sleeping issues, but this was really bad. You know, not just I can't sleep, but toss and turn and can't sleep. This coin is the result of that talk and that sleepless nights. Want to come up and share it with Susan?
I'm Susan, and I'll try to get through this without breaking up. When I first got sober, I heard Bill read this in a meeting, and I was so touched and moved, and I always meant to get a copy from him. And I actually approached him once about it, and he said, yeah, I can get you a copy. And then, I don't know, I didn't follow through, and somehow it never happened. And I knew I had to get my hands on the copy. As soon as I'd heard he passed away, so I reached out to Brad, and I know I can't do it justice. I can't read it the way Bill told it, but I'll give it a try. And it's untitled, I believe. Authored by Bill Nolan, 1984. There's a shadow in my memory from the light of a different sun. It has been there from before. Time knew, as I knew it, had begun. When I try to visualize it, all my efforts are in vain. It is measured in the solitude of the ocean and the rain. Maybe I was all alone on that distant star, and there never was another that went with me that far. There are only fragments of a love I once did touch, just an imaginary playmate, a child I loved so much. But those fragments in my memory are just pieces of my night. It's hard to tell for certain if the vision's wrong or right. It has surfaced in my solitude, an image to explain, a message that is hidden in the ocean and the rain. I think I've tried to find you in coffee shops and bars, in supermarket parking lots, on streets, at schools and cars. I did not even know who it was I'd come to find. On the altar of my reason, you had never come to mind. For beauty can't be measured on the surface of the skin, or even by the circumstance one happens to be in. It comes from other sources, other times and other places. It can't be seen by anything my conscious mind embraces. But I did not accept this, its message too obscure. I wanted something tangible. I wanted something sure. And all the bright light glistening with its clarity of sight seems so much more persuasive than those pieces of my night. Each time I thought I was so sure, and it faded and was gone. A thousand angry drums drowned out the softness of my dawn. And after all those armies finished marching to the sun, I felt a vacant, empty fog with nowhere left to run. But maybe, just maybe, those fragments that I own belong too to another, and I am not alone. And somewhere in the wilderness, those pieces of my night are the heartbeats of another that once I held so tight. And maybe, just maybe, there are pieces in your night that never were forgotten or completely out of sight. And maybe we'll remember that the loneliness and pain served only to remind us of the ocean and the rain. Sometimes I think I'm part of you, and you're a part of me, and that we never met or grew up separately. But my reason can't be trusted, and my feelings can deceive me. It is only in surrender that the ocean can receive me. No, beauty can't be measured on the surface of the skin, or even by the circumstance one happens to be in. The ocean gathers everyone and picks up every clue, and the rain falls down. Amen. It is you I love. It is you.
Hi, my name is Nancy. And I'm going to give you a little background on Bill, the evolution of Bill. When he was young, he went to the University of Minnesota. It wasn't for him. He dropped out. He worked for a major company in the city of Minneapolis, which all of you, I'm sure, have heard of, called Honeywell. He worked there several years, and that really wasn't his cup of tea either. And one day he heard an announcement on the radio about a broadcasting school. So, okay, let me try this. So he went to broadcasting school, and he got a job as a radio announcer in a small town in Minnesota called Wilmer. And he stayed there a couple years, and of course it was a small town, and there really wasn't much going on in a small Minnesota farming town. And he came back, and he went to the Minneapolis College of Art. That's what it was called at that time. It's now the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. And he got his degree there. And he started finding himself. And finding himself in his work. And then he had the opportunity to go to graduate school and get his master's degree. And he got that at the University of Washington in Seattle. After that, he taught in Kansas City, Missouri for 3 years. And then from there, it was the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in Halifax, Nova Scotia. From there, it was here to the Atlantic College of Art, where he really found himself and really grew. And he had many opportunities along the way, but when he finally started finding himself, he found that he could write. He was an excellent, excellent teacher. And I think a lot of you here in this room know what a great teacher he was. Just quietly, subtly, but making his point. And this is all history before NABBA. And once he came here, he was able to help a great many people. And that meant a great deal to him, and all of you here meant a great deal to him. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Ridgway. I wanted to let everybody know that I had the opportunity several times to be with Bill. I needed a Christmas speaker at our weekly Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting in 2014. I invited him, and the first thing he said was, "That's my daughter's birthday." I said, "Well, then I understand. Maybe we can do it another time." He said, "No, I think she would like me to do this." So I had the opportunity to record that. It is available online on the website for our speakers meeting. And we have it posted up on some of the flyers you might see. But the website address is aabluechipspeakers.org. Time to time, I'll re-listen to somebody's story, especially at a time like this. I've listened to it maybe 10 times in the last week. When I'm driving somewhere, this and the other, and I tell you, it was one of the best, just one of the best talks that I've heard. And I hope that some of it will rub off on me. And if you'd like to go to that website and download it, you can make copies and you can share it with your friends. Okay, who's next?
My name's Brett Price. I came to know Bill through NABBA and Triangle. Bill was, everybody knows that ever went to a meeting with Bill. When he would close, it was always wonderful. It was, he addressed the concept of anonymity relative to meetings and the importance of it in a statement that he enjoyed reading dramatically. And he did it well. But that's Bill, but that's a portion of Bill. Bill was obviously from what Susan just read. He was a very intelligent man. He has a book back here that's unpublished that's called The Hermetics, if you want to read something that's truly deep, dive in. But you know, prepare to swim and swim hard. Then there's you know, the illustrations that he's done for many, and for some children's books and for newspapers and for other things, and those are on the back wall as well. Bill was a demonstration of the educational variety in the fellowship. When we come here, we think we have a concept or deny a concept of something greater than ourselves. And we came here and came to understand something different, came to see a larger world than we knew existed. And Bill personified that in his outreach to just gently touch and nudge people to help them know that that world existed and that there was more than the eye could perceive. Even in his art, when he talks about sound as an element of physical art, he understood the complexity of a more complex universe. And so the phrase, "I'm not sure I understand all I think I know about that," and I think that that kind of humility was something that was at the core of who Bill was. And Bill, if you would compliment him on being well read and having said something, he would always soft pedal it, push it away from you, say, "Ah, that's nothing." But he was truly brilliant and well read, but he couldn't take credit for it. He meant a lot to many.
I'll be really quick.
You go. You go, girl.
So, hi, I'm Debbie. So, in my really early days in sobriety, I went into treatment and I had an intervention. And I looked up on the wall and I said, "I can't do this. I can't do the God, the Him, any of it." And so I was very shaky and I went to Triangle. That's where I got sober. And I kind of sat around judging everyone, "Look at all these stupid people. It's all like this church and everybody's, talking about God." And after just reading his poem, I remember that some of the things he said, he was so smart and so articulate, and his vocabulary was amazing, and he spoke to me. Allowed me to start, especially when he talked about reasonably, I can't believe there's something up there, but that he's come to change and realize that there is something bigger than us. And it actually probably saved my life. And I don't think about that because I eventually did get on my knees and ask God to keep me sober. It's been working ever since. But to find someone else who had that doubt and then grew out of it, that's what really helped me stay in this program and believe in a higher power. Thanks.
My name is Jay, and Bill was my sponsor for 7 years. And nobody knows me better than he does. And there's no way that he can be replaced, honest to goodness. When I met him, I was really, really scared. And he never bossed me around. He never told me what to do. And he always, when he gave me advice, he didn't give me advice. He brought the advice out of me. And I don't like to be bossed around. I really don't. I'm a rebellious kind of guy. And he said, "If you ever have somebody who's totally rebellious, send me your most rebellious person." He's the one he wants to challenge with. But I have a debt to him. He said, I don't know if he wanted to be my sponsor or not when I got the courage up. I asked Brad. I was too scared to ask him to be my sponsor. I asked Brad, should I ask him to be my sponsor? And he says, he'd be honored to. Oh, yeah, right. So I did. He said, I've never sponsored a drug addict before. I don't know anything about that. I said, well, I see you at every meeting I go to. I'm inspired by everything you say. He said, all right, well, I'll be your temporary sponsor because nothing lasts forever. Nothing lasts forever. But he changed. He helped change a really frightened person into God. What has God wrought? He got me out, helped me get out of my shell. I don't get nervous. I'm not nervous now. It's amazing what change he helped make in my life, and I'll be forever grateful for that.
My name is Mitchell, and I got to spend some time with Bill over the last couple of years, and he said something really funny. I was talking to him about Bob Dylan. He's like, oh yeah, I met Bob Dylan. And I was like, oh wow, what'd you think about him? He's like, he's an asshole. So I thought that was really funny. But he left this in the car I bought from him, and it looks like he read it quite a bit. But I guess I'll leave it up here. You must be his daughter?
I am, but you can keep it.
You sure?
Yes, absolutely.
I'll close with this, because this isn't easy. I was one of those rebellious type. My first sponsor, he didn't want anything to do with me. Bill took me through the work. You know, it probably saved my life. I always tried to hang out with Bill, and Bill didn't want to hang out with me. And I couldn't figure out why. And I do know one time, he's like, why do you have that gun? And I was like, I thought everybody had a gun on them. And so Bill and I were different. So, you know, there's a, it's becoming clearer and clearer why Bill didn't want to hang out with me. He heard my fifth step, too. And so we were very different. And so when I saw Bill was using a walker, I basically wouldn't take no for an answer. I was like, we're going to hang out. And Brad, you're gonna help me with this. I was able to get Mondays with Bill. And so I asked him, I said, what do you want to do? You know, what do you have left to do? What is there anything you want to do? You want to go on vacation? He said, no. He'd done everything he wanted to do. And I've never heard anybody say that. So that was very beautiful. So he said he wanted to go to meetings and go to eat. So that's what we did.
The day I should have worn heels.
Okay, hey, I'm Marilyn. And I never really had conversations with Bill, but I met Bill about 12 years ago. I was brand spanking new in recovery, and I was over at Triangle. And I was a wreck, of course, and I'm sitting there thinking I am in hell and looking and judging people and everybody. But Bill was, he always sat in this one area, at least that I recognized, and I guess by this time he was always dressed in black. And for some reason I just kept staring at him. You know, I mean, I was so new in recovery that I wasn't really listening as much as I was just looking. And I found comfort in his presence for some reason, because when he spoke, and I'm thinking, all right, what does this man have to say? But it was profound. And so I listened every single time he shared. And he'd get up there and conduct meetings as well. And I noticed when he got a haircut. So it's like, well, I must be paying some attention to something. And I think one time he wore something other than black, and I noticed that too. But, you know, eventually recovery would take hold, and I would grow from that little point. But when there was stuff, funky stuff, then I really started to listen to what other people were sharing in the meetings, finally. Because I used to just run my mouth. That's all I did. And I'd be looking around, and I would always look over at Bill. What's he doing? What's his face? What? He's cool. Just sat there cool. He's letting, you know, let the person finish sharing. And I'm sitting there going, somebody needs to say something. Get that. Shut that person up. And, you know, Bill would just wait patiently. Very, very cool. Like, raise his hand and just share something fabulous. So, those are my memories, and I'm very grateful for it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marty, and I was a colleague of Bill's at the Atlanta College of Art. I knew Bill in the pre-NABBA days, and many a Monday morning were very interesting. Bill would regale us with his activities on the previous weekend. He spent a good bit of time at the Stein Club. After several years, he first went to NA. I'm not sure what year he came here. But he had really developed a devoted following. I'll echo what Nancy said. He really was highly regarded by his students, and that always remains a high priority with him. He was also our department head in what we at the time called Visual Studies, which was the freshman design program. And we really treasured the nature of that program. He really encouraged, there were four of us in the department, and he encouraged us to teach from our strengths. We didn't really teach from a book. So we had very different approaches, but we really functioned as a cohesive department. This was on the back table. I'll put it back there when we finish. I know you can't see it from here, but this is an example of Bill's artwork, but it also is a picture of the Visual Studies department. There were four faculty members, and using what was cutting-edge technology at the time, the four of us morphed into each other. And I was so happy to see this when I came in today. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Mark. I also taught with Bill at the Atlanta College of Art. I was there for 19 years. And one of the few things that people don't know, which was brought up earlier about Bill, he was a fashion plate also. He wore black before anybody in New York did. So, and I just have two real short stories about Bill, and I always considered Bill a real character. I think everybody can agree with that. He was just this wonderfully individual, and he did a lot of great things, and I always call him a smart artist too, because his art always had a good strong idea behind it. I feel fortunate. I've got a piece they had produced digitally where he took himself in his black clothes, of course, and he put himself between Bush and Cheney. And he had this, he was looking down just like they were, as if, and just replaced the third person in there. So what Marty just said, showing that piece of artwork, that Bill was always thinking in that direction. And one small story, this is just a minute thing, a little thing about Bill that might be a little quirky, maybe a little different, but I think everybody knew Bill. Slowly, his body was rejecting the enamel part of his body. In other words, he started losing his teeth, I guess. And I remember at the Atlanta College of Art, it's just an appropriate story. I don't hope it is. But he didn't replace his teeth, which was, no one ever said anything. That was himself. I remember the Atlanta College of Arts they opened up this small cafeteria at the school, and the food was okay. And usually in the morning, we'd be sitting there having breakfast. And once in a while, Bill would be there too. And just to end this short story, is that Bill always complained because they didn't have enough soft food. And that was Bill. And it was said in a way that was very funny, in a way that it was kind of a joke. But he was serious, but it was a joke at the same time. So that split about him as being very, very smart, which he was, a very smart person, but very funny too, in all respects. So, thank you.
Hi, my name is Wynn. If there hadn't been pictures out front that we're talking about the same Bill Nolan that I know, I would not have recognized him by what's been said so far, because I only knew him when he was at Lake Lanier. And I noticed there was a little model boat back there, and he was in that boat when I met him. And he was dressed in black, and he had some teeth, I think, at that point. Sorry. But I was amazed at this old guy who was out there kicking everybody's butt in the middle of August, wearing black, and sailing around the course, and you'd say something to him, and he'd turn and say, "What?" I bet nobody here has ever heard him say that. Well, yeah. He was always a very interesting fella, for sure. But he never mentioned NABA, he never mentioned AA, and I never knew that there was this whole other side of him. I did see some of his artwork over the years, but mostly I just remember him out there in a sailboat having a good time, competing very well up into his late years. I shouldn't say that because I'm 77 and I'm getting to those late years myself. But he will be missed up at Lake Lanier, and Willie and I remember him from way back, and it's just sad to see one of the characters on the lake fade away. Thank you.
If any of you haven't been out on the boat, Mike, I want to put on the record kind of what it was like. I sailed with Bill for several summers. I think this was between 2004-2008. Like every weekend, he would come about 7 a.m., pick me up at my house. He was not wearing black. He was wearing a white T-shirt and that hat. We drive out to Lake Lanier from Midtown Atlanta. And he was coming from, I forget where he was, Douglasville was where he was living then? And he would come down to Atlanta, pick me up, and then we would drive out to the lake. A lot of times he would just, the first thing he'd do is go to the clubhouse and look out at the lake, and he'd say, he'd look out there for a little while, and then he'd say, "It looks kind of hairy. I don't know if I can do this. I'm an old man. You need bones like, what is it, bones like hard rubber and muscles like steel cable to be able to sail in this kind of weather." And a lot of times I wouldn't be feeling too up to it, and I'd be like, "Yeah, it looks kind of bad. Maybe we shouldn't go out." But most of the time we did, because he would go around, and Wynn knows this, he would go around to everybody out there at the lake and say the same thing to them. He'd say, "Gosh, looks kind of hairy out there. I don't know if I'm going to go out." And then everybody would say, "Yeah, go out, Bill. What are you talking about? You got a young man with you." So then we go out, and these were sailboat races. So this was two guys involved in competitive sport out there on the lake. It was a special experience for me, and for a lot of years I considered him one of my closest friends. We did this every weekend, and I just wanted to kind of put that on the record, you know, what that was like. Thanks.
And my name is Don from the Bills. Bill often would say that making art made him really miserable. It was very miserable for him, but not making it would make it even more miserable. Losing Bill is unspeakably miserable for me, but if I had not had the opportunity to know him, I wouldn't be able to describe how much more miserable it would be.
This is hard. I'm emotional. I'm Jennifer. So I met Bill at this little establishment called Atlanta College of Art. He was my very first professor. He was my very first instructor in my quest for a higher learning. And so on the first day, I walk in, and there's this elderly, intimidating looking guy, all black, a little on the pudgy side. This is real. This is really happening. I'm in college now. You know, I came from this little podunk town in Georgia. And I was in the big city now, and I was doing this liberal arts thing. And so he had this thing where he listed off 1 through 100. He'd say 1, and he'd point to somebody, and we would give him a word, an adjective, a noun, a verb, anything, a word. 1, cat. 2, apple. 3, and so on, all the way to 100. After that, we took a 10-minute break, came back. He didn't move a muscle, stayed in the same place. Then one right after the other, we would shoot off a number, and he would tell us that word. He remembered them all. 1 through 100. He didn't write them down. It was so amazing. He was brilliant. He was just brilliant. That was a required course, and then I had a experimental sound with him, which was enlightening, to put it mildly. He helped me tap into all of my senses, you know. He really made me the artist that I am today. He was hypersensitive to the laws of physics, you know, just every energy that is plausible in the universe. He conveyed it. He was able to articulate that energy. You know, he was a mentor, and he was like a father. And he would give advice, he would listen, and it was always subtle. He never demanded respect. He just casually commanded it, you know. Anyway, thanks.
I'm Max. I'm glad I'm here today, and I was aware somewhat of how kind of profound Bill was as an intellectual and an artist and a teacher, but it occurs to me that the way he affected me was not unique, and that's a wonderful thing. He had a very large impact on me right when I moved to Atlanta and was getting sober, and he was the resident old timer at the Triangle meeting that I was going to. He was he was kind of one of the rocks in the meeting, and I knew I needed to ask somebody to sponsor me, and he was the only person I felt comfortable asking because he was so in some way approachable that other people weren't. And I was terrified of, you know, asking anybody anything, but he said he would be my temporary sponsor, and I took that as an affront. I thought he was saying, you know, God, I don't want to. So I hated him for a couple of years after that. I strongly disliked him. But I called him one day because I was coming unglued, and I thought I was going to go drink or hurt somebody or do something crazy. And it was in the middle of the day on a work day, and I was sitting behind the restaurant I worked in, and I mean I was coming apart, you know, like crying uncontrollably and freaking out. And I don't remember at all what we talked about, but he stayed on the phone with me until I had calmed down enough to go back inside. And after that, I started dating a young lady in the program that he had taken a shine to, and so that that sort of rekindled our relationship. He would always ask me how she was, and we started talking again. And I started coming back to Triangle after several years here at NABA, and at some point I realized that the lesson Bill had imparted on me was that I needed to be, to some degree, mentally independent. I had hoped that what he would do was tell me what to do. You know, I thought I needed someone to just tell me what to do. And Bill's style and the way he approached helping other people was never commanding. At least never in my experience, and it sounds like that was kind of his MO. And later I realized how important that was, and I just like to say he used to recite a poem. I don't think he wrote it, but correct me if I'm wrong, but it went, I sought my God eluded me. Or I sought my God I couldn't see. I sought my soul, it too eluded me. When I sought my brother, I found all three. Coming from my background and being as permanently agnostic as I am, those three lines meant a whole lot to me. And Bill meant a lot to me. When he used to do the 12 tradition reading at the end, we were in a meeting together one time, and you know, everyone does the hand gestures or whatever, and I came up with my own set of hand gestures to kind of mock everybody else. My seat was right across from where Bill always sat. So we're always next to each other and could see each other. I did my hand gestures one time, and one of them is pretty lewd. And Bill, and this was, you know, this was kind of in his later years when he would kind of repeat questions and all that. But he got this fiery look in his eye, and he started laughing real hard, and it was pretty wonderful. So that's it.
I'm Brooke Lefke. Bill and I shared hometowns, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the first time I met Bill, I didn't know the thing about counting to 100. I never heard that story before. But in Minneapolis, there's a grid system, and the streets start off Aldridge, Bryant, Colfax. Well, Bill could repeat all the whole grid system, all the names of the avenues, and that, I mean, heck, I've lived there most of my life, and I can't do that. But I'll just say this regarding Bill's influence in my life. And I know I'm telling a story about me, but I know it's the experience of many of you here. I had started coming in the rooms of AA. I walked into the Triangle Club on April 20th, 2003. And I was sober for 22 months, and I found a home group in Minneapolis, and I found Triangle was my group here. But for years, for years I would go to the meeting, I'd get to the meeting at the last moment, and then I'd take off at the end of the meeting, and I didn't have any home group meetings, I'd go to different ones. And I was sober for periods, but I kept relapsing, and then I'd have to check myself in to the bug farm, I call it, the psychiatric hospital, because I was having suicidal ideation. This went on for years. I mean, most of the time I was sober, but then I relapsed, and then I ended up in the, well, in the autumn of 2009, I had a dear friend, an older gentleman, who was dying here in Atlanta. So I decided to spend the winter here. And I had started on my present sobriety in January of 2009, but and I hadn't had anything to drink, but I was pretty, we say dry. I was pretty sketchy about, you know, I was like not grounded. Well, because of being here so much and being my friend who was dying, my older friend, was a terrific night owl, I was staying up really late. So I started hitting a meeting at the Triangle Club, the Tri-Night Flight, which meets at 10 o'clock on weeknights and 11 on weekends, and I began to get to know Bill. And I had a rapport with Bill, and I liked to ask him questions about things, and he'd ask me questions about things, about, you know, perspective of things. And at some point, when I realized how much time I was going to be spending here, I was a little flummoxed, because I have a sponsor in Minneapolis. But I thought, well, I'm spending so much time here, maybe I could have a sponsor here. So I talked it over with Bill, because I was under the impression that one has one sponsor, that's it. But Bill asked me, Bill said that with good, there could be a sponsor team like Sponsee Brothers, and that it didn't have to be, I mean, somebody who wanted to be, who wasn't serious about the program could play, like he or she could play one sponsor against another. That's not what I was interested in doing. And so over the time, Bill and I talked a lot, and back then Bill would come out to fellowship after the meeting at the Landmark at the diner. And one of the concepts I'd had a really difficult time getting was the God concept. And a lot of my difficulties with that had been Bill's difficulties in that. We had some similarities in that. And, Bill, spending time with Bill and having a support network, I was able just to start stringing together days and weeks and months and eventually years of sobriety. And I'd say Bill had a really, he was never, quote, my sponsor, but he certainly was a sponsor. And I really can attribute my 8-year sobriety, Bill had a terrific influence. And as far as his teaching abilities, I come from a line of teachers. He had that way of pulling forth the answer from you, instead of dogmatically telling you. And also he introduced me to the concept, I didn't know, that people have different learning styles. And I wish some people, when I was back in school, had said that to me, because I was really bright, but I'd often get lousy grades, because I didn't know how to do it and do that particular kind of learning. So I really appreciated that for Bill for that. And the last few weeks when he was in the hospital, away in Minnesota, but we got to talk, and I knew he was having a hard time of it. And I'm just very, and all of you here, my life was and is immeasurably made better by the presence of Bill Nolan in my life. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Michael, and I've known Bill for about 8 years now. In 2008 and 9, I had was in a lot of trouble, and in 2009 I was given a lengthy prison sentence, but they let me out upon completion of the DeKalb County Drug Court Program, which not many people complete that program. I've been out for about 2 weeks in a halfway house, and the closest place for me to go is Triangle. I needed to get a sponsor. I had a lot of things in this program I had to do in order not to do what they wanted me to do. My first attempt was a group that tried to recruit me, and I'm not going to say any names, but they took me for a walk, and the next few days I was like, I'm going to end up going to prison and failing DeKalb County Drug Court if I... So I asked around, and they pointed me to this older gentleman that was sitting behind the desk, and I went up to him, and I think what a lot of people shared was what he had told them as well. I said, do you know about sponsorship? Well, sure, I'll be your temporary sponsor. And I wasn't really, I just asking. And so he didn't have a cell phone. And it kind of forced me to go to Triangle to see him. We started meeting every Thursday for an hour at 7 o'clock before the 8 o'clock speaker meeting. And I met with Bill for about 2.5 years. Every Thursday at 7 o'clock till 8. And that was an hour a week of time that I got to spend with him. Went through the big book, back and forth, word for word, page for page, the 12 and 12. And I've never had somebody be so patient and so simple. Whenever I had an issue, he didn't direct me and give me instructions, but he shared any experience he had. And if he didn't have it, he wouldn't share it with me. And he would tell me, I have no experience with that. That's all I can let you know. And it was good because he had a lot of really simple solutions that ended up still helping me on a daily basis. I'll tell you one thing. I never felt like there was anyone in that time period to complete this program that I can confide in, except for Bill. And I don't think I would have completed that program without Bill. I went there for a while every week. I had so many resentments against the government. I would go in there and just bitch and complain the whole hour. And Bill would come up with a simple solution. It was easy. Car's broke, take it to a mechanic. Your refrigerator's broke, take it to the refrigerator repairman. You need to stay sober, come here. And that's as simple as it got. And I'm forever grateful for having him in my life. And it's really a feeling of true gratitude to know that we crossed paths. I'm forever grateful for that. So that's all I got. Thank you.
Hi, I'm John. I was a student of Bill's. I remember that memory trick that he taught. I don't remember the specifics, but the mechanics of it, when he explained it, have helped me when I need to remember something. I'm much better at that now. I wish I'd remembered. I wish I'd taken more notes about some things that he taught, because for decades in the back of my head I've had, oh, this one detail, or what was number 7 of that, you know, that I've been meaning to get around to asking, and you know, I never really got the chance. But at least you know, he always had these small little these small ideas that sounded insignificant in the way that he delivered them. They were not the obvious, what was obvious, but it was always something that was really essential that anyone else would miss. But always very practical. He was very practical. And I remember one of the things he said when I was first starting there at the Atlanta Culture Bar was that he was telling the story about how in his first art history classes, what he learned was that he tended to fall asleep when the lights were dimmed and someone was speaking in monotone, and that was worth it. Whatever you learn is worth it. So what I do remember from I'll cherish, and is, you know, that actually, you know, I have to say, the entire the teaching staff and administration were, it was really a special place, and he was, I've learned, you know, since then, you know, how much, I'm sorry, I'm trying not to remember too, but anyways, I don't have an ending, just some thoughts.
Thank you.
Hey everybody, my name's Adam. Jealous of all you guys. You had a story that made sense. I don't think I have that. I got to know Bill in the year 2000 when I met him at the Atlanta College of Art. He was my first art professor. My first thing in the morning, I was still drinking my second cup of coffee when I got with Bill every day. And kind of older, kind of intimidating, kind of pudgy. And he kind of lets you know very subtly, I know what I'm doing, you might want to shut up. And I did, and I listened to that guy, and I never regretted any time I spent with him. And after visual studies, the first semester was over, I enjoyed his class because he challenged me. I really learned to see things in a different way than I ever had before. They called it visual studies. I would have called it visual literacy, because I just couldn't see until I met him and the rest of the department at ACA. It was a great department. It really was. People did teach from their strengths, and he really pulled that out of everybody he met and spent any significant amount of time with. That's a talent that he honed into a very sharp skill over time. He was a very multi-talented individual. And his whole thing was, it was subtle. It was just that he was always keeping the conversation going. There was never an end. There was never an end to any conversation, any statement, any learning, any whatever he was doing. And he had the humility to know how temporary all this is, and to be a good friend, and to be a great teacher, and to be a very good sponsor to a lot of people. And he did pick up on the subtleties that other people would miss. That amount of intelligence coupled with that amount of humility, I feel very fortunate to have known Bill for this long, and to just see how he interacted with people. You know, I think the last few years I kind of kept a distance from him because I just didn't want to hurt so bad when this day inevitably came. But I got to spend time with him talking about art, talking about recovery. I knew him from the Atlanta College of Art, and then he found me on the porch at Triangle. He said, "Adam, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Turns out I got a drinking problem." He said, "What?" He says, "It turns out I've got a real fucking drinking problem." He said, "Yeah, me too." So He got it. Artists, we're sensitive people. We feel things very deeply, you know. We need some way to cope with it. And, you know, he found both routes that I took, and so it was very easy for me to see him as a role model and as a very particularly strong figure in both the environments from which I knew him, both in school and in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was that very casual rock in the room, you know. He knew who had the ability to keep it cool. I did see him pissed off a couple of times, and that was awesome. he had a fire deep within. But I think that he helped shape and mold a lot of people in this room to some extent, and the conversation will go on. Thanks, Bill.
I have a little different perspective on Bill than I think what I've heard from most of y'all in here. I come from the Sailing Club, and I'm not going to use the microphone. I can speak loud enough. And I met Bill early 2000s, sailing, and Adam talked about his fire. If you really want to see him PO'd, go out and watch him race sailboats. And you know, we get very close to each other, and we foul each other. And Bill is no exception that any of the rest of us to get fired up at any given time when somebody did him wrong. So he was a great friend of ours up there at the Sailing Club, a personal, really great friend of mine. So I felt like I had to come down here. I wouldn't have felt good about it not coming down. So Adam says something about the long conversations. You ever talk to him on the phone? You know, I'll tell you, you know, sometimes you can't get off the phone with them. I think the last time I talked to Bill was probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago, and I was trying to ask him if he had something, because I was constantly he was constantly giving me stuff to hold for him, and then I'd give him stuff to hold for me, and back and forth, the next thing you know, I'm like, where's this to go? So I called Bill and said, hey, have you seen the cover for this boat? No, you got it. I said, no, I don't got it. No, you got it. So he said, that ended up being a 45, 50 minute conversation. But I'll give you a little hint about Bill. The thing that I learned about Bill is that I guess it was probably mid-2000s, and I had an older boat, and I was doing real well with it, but the boat just wasn't as, I always said, I'll keep the boat as long as the boat's as good as I am. Once I get better in the boat, then I got to get rid of it. Well, in the national ranks, I was climbing up through the ranks a little bit, and I got about 6th to 10th in that area. And the boat just wasn't capable of being any better than that. So the Nationals, 2008, the Nationals were going to be in Fort Walton Beach. So I went to Bill at the Sailing Club and said, hey, you don't have any plans of going to Fort Walton Beach, do you? Which I knew he didn't. And he said, no. I said, well, is there any way I could borrow your boat? Because he had a fast boat. And he said, sure. By all means, you can take it down there with you. Well, of course, I get down there, and the boat's a lot faster than what I'm used to being on. And I'm all over the map. Well, I came back, and Bill said to me, he goes, well, you know, I really don't like that boat. And I said, what do you mean you don't like it? It's the fastest boat in the fleet. And he said, well, it doesn't fit. I can't sit in it right. I can't get my butt in it right. So he purchased another boat. And this is classic Bill Nolan. He sells me his boat and lets me pay him on time for the boat, because I couldn't afford to pay the price of the boat. So over the course of the next 2 years, I paid the boat off monthly to Bill Nolan. And I still have the boat. And in 2011, I won two national championships with that boat.
Wow.
So that's my Bill Nolan story. Great guy. Great friend of all of the sailors. I wish that more of them would have come down, but I understand. I didn't know him as long as some of the other guys did. He'd been up there a long, long time. They had great relationships with him, and we're blessed to have known him. Thanks.
I'm Colleen. And one story I haven't heard told yet that I wanted to include for the recording that I always loved that Bill would say was when he would pick up his chips. when he would pick up his chips for his anniversaries, he would say something along the lines, and I don't have a very good memory, but something along the lines of, thank you all for being here tonight, and thank you all for being here that night when I first walked in the rooms. Your names were different, your faces were different, but you were here, and thank you for being here when the next guy walks in. And your names will be different, and your faces will be different, but you will be here. And I always loved how that spoke to the spirit of how connected and how every little moment that we are together is part of a bigger chain of moments, that we're all truly connected in the 12 step. So, you know, that meeting you go to tonight, you know, there may be that person who walks in and you will connect with them, and 5-10 years from now you won't be in the room physically, but another newcomer will walk in and that person you talk to will be in that room and they will pass it on. And that has always meant been very special to me. I did know Bill from those rooms for about 10 years now. He was one of the first people I also met at the clubhouse at Triangle Club. But we didn't talk so much about recovery because I was a jealous art student. I didn't actually take fine arts classes. I took digital arts and studied graphic design, but I always wanted to be what I considered a real artist. I just didn't have the skills, so I listened to the lessons he would teach, and he gave me a few little tricks and suggestions, a few assignments. One assignment he gave me, if anyone wants to try something fun, he told me to go get a well of India ink and pick a branch up off the street or whatever. And don't look for a good, he said, don't look for a good branch. Don't look for one that has a point. Just pick up any stick that you see and try to draw something. And what he was challenging me to do was, because I was taught in digital arts, I was very premeditated. I always said, okay, this is what I want to create, and this is how I'm going to put it on the paper. And I could do that on a computer better than I could do it with my hands. And so that's what he was trying to get me to do, is to break that by taking a medium like India ink, which will just spill all over the paper, and a stick that has no well for the ink. And all I can do is dip and scratch and dip and scratch and dip and scratch and see what could come of it. And actually, the thing that I created doing that, one of them my sister fell in love with and has it hanging in her house because of them. But he also gave my sister another gift, which was something to ridicule with me with for the rest of forever, because she loves opportunities like that. Because I shared with her another trick that Bill taught me. My husband is colorblind, and we tease that I might be a tetrachromat, which means that you might have that fourth cone to see colors in deeper depths, because I've always described color differently. And so one day we were talking about this, and he was helping me put to words what I could always kind of perceive but not really express by talking about the color of somebody's shirt and trying to say, you know, what color is Brooke's shirt? And I would say, well, it's burgundy. And he goes, no, it's not. That's not burgundy. And he would start to describe the layers of color that built that burgundy and how to see. He says, so that's a blue shirt. And I was trying to understand what he was saying, and I eventually came to understand it. Like, at the base of it, it's blue with a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it built the color. Well, I made the mistake of telling my sister this story, and so now whenever I'd be like, oh, that's a cool whatever color or whatever thing, and she goes, is it really that color? Is it really? And I'm like, oh. So I will always have Bill with me whenever my sister feels the need to poke and prod in that. So those are my stories. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Alex. I'm going to jump in here before I got to go. I knew Bill not as a close friend. He was always there, the casual rock as he was. Brad is my sponsor, though, so there was many times where Brad and Bill would be doing something together and I'd go along. I came into this program not by choice, and so there was a lot of fear and anxiety in my life. And there are times in your lives where, I know this to be true for me, somebody will say something and it will hit you like a ton of bricks. And the one time that Bill really just hit the nail on the head for me was we were in a meeting and he said, "Fear is good. Fear is a natural instinct. You see a snake, you get scared, you have that fight or flight instinct. It is a survival thing. And you get adrenaline rush, it's this whole thing. Worry is the perversion of fear. When you worry about something, it's that same reaction of fear, but drawn out over a longer period, and we're not designed to handle that. So worry is the perversion of fear. So recognize that when you're worried about something, you're not actually worried about something, you're scared of something. Figure out what that something is and handle that." And for some reason, that completely changed my perspective on stuff, to the point where a week or so later I was talking to my therapist and I said, "You know, worry is the perversion of fear." And my therapist went, "What? Hold on, but say that again. That was really, I gotta write this down. Hold on." And he was full of brilliant insights like that, that there'd be so many of them flying at you that, you know, you'd catch on to the ones that you could, but you wouldn't be able to hold on to all of them. So that's my story. Thanks.
I'm going to tell some stories about my dad. How many of you knew he played the guitar? He actually used to play it all the time. He used to sing me a song called "One Proud Porpoise." I have no clue where the words are. I don't know much about that tune, but I remember he used to play his guitar and sing that to me all the time. I have that guitar. He bought a Goya Classic. I believe it was used at the time. And it makes a really pretty sound. So, really nice. We talk about seeing him pissed off. If you've ever, like they said, racing, if you ever crewed for him, he uses lots of choice words with his teenage daughter when she was crewing for him. Of course, I just gave it right back to him because it was usually his fault for not telling me what he was about getting ready to do in the boat. And I wasn't able to anticipate and read his mind. And then he'd get, he was highly competitive, so trust me, he got mad, he got red-faced, he swore all the time, and yet he was not a sailor. He was a racer. That's what actually brought him pleasure, is getting out in the boat and then getting pissed off and yelling if things weren't right, and he was always complaining about the wind and where it was and all that kind of stuff. So you always think he's a nice, sweet, gentle guy. Go out sailing with him, you would learn a whole different side. But as soon as he got to the shore, it was all left out of the lake. It never went anywhere. So you would think, okay, I don't remember learning how to sail. It was just always a part of my life. I can do starboard and port better than I could do right and left. You say right and left, I go, okay, this is the right side. Starboard and port, I can just do instantly. As a child, he only took me out on the boat when the weather was rough and windy and white-capped because he needed ballast. Basically, he needed more weight on the boat to keep it from tipping over. It's like, I think there was a 500-pound limit on the Sea Scouts when he was out racing, and him and his partner came really close to that 500 pounds, and I was about the only thing that could fit in underneath that 500 pounds and still give him more weight. When I went racing with him at Lake Lanier in my high school days, I would go up there to the lake, and if it was a light wind, I sat on the shore. It's like, okay, have fun, guys. When it was rough and windy, that's when he brought me on board again to go racing with him. So
I spent many times doing that. The picture of him in the boat back there, I got to pick those colors for that boat. There's that model boat right in front of it that's broken. He made that. He put it together. It was very carefully delivered to me. I very carefully put it in my car, and I was very proud to have that boat. I was taking it down to college with me, and I finally got down there, and I had the dog in the car. And the dog was really excited to finally be there. And she stepped on the boat. So the reason you don't see the sail with that boat or anything, I actually gave it back to him asking if he could repair it. I never saw it again until I came back down here to his house a couple weeks ago. I thought it was very interesting. If you notice, it does work. Actually, you could pull those boards up and down, and everything does work on it. So it's sort of pretty interesting there. I will say, you know, you talk about him as a teacher and all that. He did not know how to deal with kids. He needed someone who had enough up here in the head to understand all the nuances that he was going to do. And little kids aren't really good on nuances. My mom once asked him to teach a class at the elementary school. You want to talk about someone who was nervous? He was scared to death to talk to about sixth graders, I think. He didn't know how to deal with them. But he was going to teach him about color and that. And it was actually funny from my perspective to watch how scared he was as a teacher in front of a classroom because they were kids. It was really an amusing aspect of him is he much more wanted those intellectual types of people. I never learned to play checkers. I learned to play chess. If any of you know, he was a big chess player. So that's what I was taught as a child. I know one of our neighbors needed someone to play cards with. So my first card game was not Go Fish or Crazy Eights. It was Gin Rummy. And that was when we lived in Kansas City. So I remember also being used as a measuring tool. I think one of his colleagues at in Missouri was trying to build a really weird wooden contraption bike type of thing, and he needed a child to put on there to figure out where to put the foot pedals. So I was used as that measuring device for that kind of stuff. So we used to have letters people wrote us hanging on the wall because they wrote them on long pieces of paper or out of like eggs or anything like that. You know, he didn't receive normal letters, and so we actually hung them on the wall. So some of the interesting things, I didn't understand that that's not the normal way to grow up. Most people, you know, I talk to, it's like, oh, well, that's not how my life was. Things like that. So I'm really glad to hear people have all these stories. I really appreciate them. I don't know if anyone knew that he used to run a popcorn cart in his younger days. Yep. Get out there with a little popcorn cart selling popcorn. Someone tried to talk him into buying two and expanding. He wasn't very good with business, so that didn't end up working out for him, kind of deal. So he was also a delinquent. I don't know if anyone knew that. He actually got in trouble with the law as a young child. I think failing is part of what helped him get out of that situation. So, you know, his father died when he was 11. His father was actually a congressman and a lieutenant governor. He had nine half-sisters. I think the youngest was somewhere around 15 years old when he was born. So he pretty much grew up an only child. So he had a very unique life growing up. So. But he really enjoyed very much all the teaching, and he loved to play chess, and I remember he always said he donated a chessboard to one of these clubs here so that there'd be a chessboard here to play with sometimes and things like that. So I want to encourage any more stories, absolutely, but I also want to encourage people to eat all the food that we have here for him as well. So feel free to have more stories, but I want to thank you guys for being here and sharing things and hang around and just chit-chat, talk. It'll be really great. Thanks.
So my name is Frank Vandal. I met Bill maybe 25, 30 years ago, so I'm not aware of anything his daughter had to say. I came up to the lake, and he was sailing the MC, and he was past his prime in regard to sailing, so he was a mentor in terms of saying, get out there and do it, be in nature, have a good day, things like that. It was always charming. I don't believe he ever had a temper. I don't accept what she says. So Bill was there with this little girl, young girl, very young girl. And I said, "Oh, who are you?" And she says, "I'm Gidget Nolan." And I said, "Oh, his daughter, I'm sure." And she said, "No, I'm his wife." So Bill was like 65 at that time. Is Gidget here? Am I looking at Gidget? All right. So Gidget was, does anyone know her age when they got married?
He was 21 when they got married.
So what's the difference?
He was 55, she was 21.
I can't do that kind of math.
34
years difference. So probably the age could have been his daughter. Yeah.
She's 4 years younger than me.
Younger than his daughter. So I said to Gidget one time, because she would come up a lot, I said to Gidget, "How'd he get you?" And she said, "He didn't." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, he didn't tell me their whole background. But the way the story goes from Gidget's perspective was, she said, "Bill, will you marry me?" And there's this Bill Nolan pause. He lived on pauses. You know, he could take you apart with a pause. And so there's this long pause, and Gidget said, "Okay, Bill, you got 20 more seconds. If you don't say yes, you're going to miss the best thing in your life." So Bill wasn't stupid, and he used his time well to say yes. And how many years were they together? 11 years. And just a footnote, I think the reason they broke up was she wanted to have children and he refused because he was getting older and so on. That's what I...
Yes.
Is that right? And they remained very close friends always?
Her new husband used to take him to doctor's appointments.
Her new husband took Bill to doctor's appointments. And he was very close with her family, I believe.
Yes.
I'm not even that close with my girlfriend. So on the race course, he was always charming. He was unflappable. He always brought young, interesting art students up and took them sailing. And as she said, it's not easy. I don't know. There may be an art student here. Whether he yelled at them, I doubt it. No.
Yeah, we...
Well, they were racing, but we sailors reserve our screaming for those we love. So take it as a compliment. So So the only other story, and it's not a great... First of all, I loved you and was enormously proud of you. You know, what are you, a rocket scientist or the head of the CIA or something like that? Anyhow, she's smarter than all the brains in the room, you know, as you can tell. So she was the problem with Bill not having abilities with children, I mean. So they had this party at his house, 60th maybe, new house, condo they moved into. And he invited everybody from the yacht club and so on. So I went. And I'm from a family of art. My mother was an artist. My father was an artist. My brother taught art. I have zero talent of any type. Can't play the guitar. Ignored my children. So there was no art in the house. I walk around the house. Where's the art? What's he do? He's been at SCAD. He founded... Is there anyone here from SCAD? Any SCAD? He hated SCAD. I mean, he was at Atlanta School of Art, and for some reason he loved Atlanta School of Art, and SCAD bought them out, and I guess bought him out. He didn't complain about how he left. He just wanted to stay with Atlanta School of Art. So, not so.
Well, he would have taught until he died.
Okay. He would have taught until he died if it wasn't for SCAD, she said. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to teach till I die. I'm pretty much there. So, I just wanted to say I love Phil. I never heard a cross word. I threw as many darts at him as I could. He dodged them. He was always friendly. A nice guy to be around. Uplifting to see a person of that age sailing. Sailing is a tough sport. I just have one more question for Bill. Just get it ready for me, baby, and I'll be there.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Norman. Most people call me Norman, and that was a colleague of Bill Mullins from the day he set foot at the Atlanta School of Art in 1971, which later became the Atlanta College of Art. Just a short time ago, I had lunch with Anthony Greco. I don't know if Tony's here today. Is he here? And we thought we were going to, it was my idea to do this, to sit down and figure out a way where we could jointly make some comments about Bill and post those comments on the internet in some manner where people could continue to bring in their input. I'm still working on that because my son is a graduate of Georgia Tech and he's going to help me work out the technicalities of how that can happen. So stay tuned. Now, when I was having lunch with Tony, he told me about an assignment that he had been given when he was a student where they had to write an essay and contain that essay onto a single page. And he thought it was a good exercise because when I talked to my son Matt about this, he said, most people don't pay attention to the long comments that people make on Facebook. And you'd be better off saying something more succinct and then have a repository where people can make their comments at length. And then somehow in that conversation with Tony, I told him that I sometimes am long-winded, which I am probably going to be here this afternoon. And he said, I haven't noticed that, Norman. And there's a lot of truth to that. I don't know if it's a character flaw or not, but I tend to be long-winded. So the exercise we put forth to each other was we were going to go back to our homes and write something and try to be as concise as possible. Tony contacted me via email the following day, and he titled it, Nolan's Stuff. It's said, I tried, but I couldn't. I'm not happy with what I did. I'll get up tomorrow morning and try again. So then he contacted me again, and he sent me the text of what he had written down, and he wasn't sure whether it was okay. And I texted him back and said, I think it's just great. And I was still in the mode of procrastinating because of all of my experiences with Bill, and I was trying to figure out how I was going to condense what I was going to say in that short, compressed page that we had talked about, and it become almost nearly impossible. And in fact, I have what I have written, and it's still incomplete. So, before I start that, though, I've got to present something to you that was requested of me by a dear friend of Bill, Joanne Wolfe, who is the publisher of his book Handprint. And she texted me, she's been sending me a bunch of texts in the last couple of days, and she wanted me to read this quotation from Bill that he had given to her when she had fallen on hard times, and she was having a difficult time with a divorce that she was going through, and her life was not in very good shape at the time. And when she brought this to his attention, he said, I wrote that. I'm going to read it to you now. When things happen spontaneously as a result of natural forces, there's a beauty and an elegance about them that can't be duplicated by contrivance. And I'm doing this for her because she requested that I present it to you. My reminiscences of Bill go all the way back to 1971, which is a very interesting time because 1971 is when he did the project on Fraser Lake, the conceptual project on Fraser Lake in Nova Scotia, and it was just a short time after he did that project that he came to Atlanta to become a professor at the Atlanta School of Art, because at that time it was still the Atlanta School of Art and did not become the Atlanta College of Art until John Rogers decided it was time for it to be a college because of the expansion of the liberal arts program and the expansion of the studio program. So this is what I have written so far. Upon his arrival at the Atlanta School of Art in 1971, Bill Nolan made a strong impression on students who were ready for new ideas. We had just come out of that situation where there was a lot of protesting going on of the Vietnam War and the conditions of the college. I remember them very vividly because I was there. It was an uneasy environment when John Rogers first came in. In fact, there were some of us on the faculty who actually were not happy with the appointment of John Rogers because it was done without our consultation. And we went and protested to Charles Jagels, who at the time was the president of the Arts Alliance. And we met with him, and of course it didn't do us a whole lot of good. We consequently had a meeting with John Rogers, who had already been hired, and we informed him of our dissatisfaction with him being hired without our consultation, and he actually told us that he was in sympathy with what we said, but the decision had already been made, and we're just going to have to try to work together. That's the way he put it to us. So, actually, during his tenure, it was really a pretty good and very interesting time. Again, referring to Bill, he wasted no time in introducing the Atlanta School of Art community, some of his ideas about art and the avant-garde, which was his milieu when he taught students at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. He stimulated the foundation design educational program by inviting artists to ACA who were involved in the international art scene, such as Willoughby Sharp,
who was the co-founder with Lisa Bear of Avalanche Magazine, James Lee Byers, and others. It was an exciting time. Bill's educational philosophy infused into the first year foundation design program for the Atlanta College of Art is far-reaching. Bill would visit the Atlanta College of Art printmaking department periodically, and particularly when he sought technical guidance for one of his artistic endeavors. I recall collaborating with him on a six-color serigraph for which I cut the stencils and printed the edition. Bill presented to me the signed bonneteer of that print. For those of you that do not know what a bonneteer is, that's an impression that the artist approves for editioning, or in the, it would even hold true in the printing industry when someone approves of something that needs to go and be printed, like of the final stripe. I approve this, you can go ahead and print it. He presented me with that bonneteer, and interestingly enough, there's no date on it, but I attribute the date to sometime during the 1970s, shortly after he became a professor at ACA. It's a very beautiful print. I have it here today. I'd like for you all to view it later on when the time is appropriate. The title of the print is Air, Fire, Water, Earth. It's an interesting to note that the collaboration It is interesting to note that during the collaboration, at least one of the printing sessions was occurring simultaneously with one of the well-known ACA Halloween parties. And those of you that have attended those knew how exciting those were. The most interesting collaboration with Bill was in the design of his book, Handprint, which chronicles the teaching of his first semester foundation course at ACA. This project started with digital recordings, my interviewing him at the Triangle Club, Atlanta. Those turned into less focused monologues that, however, did contain the essence of a beginning. He had it all in his head. We just had to get it down in written form. Bill and I spent countless hours side by side in front of my computer, gradually developing the text paragraph by paragraph, chapter by chapter, as he wrote out his thoughts in a small wired personal notebook full of notes, scribbles, etc. There it is. That's the notebook. You all can look in there. It's kind of an interesting thing. Somehow, it worked. Lunch on those days, one of his favorites, medium rare roast beef sandwich on mountain bread with the crust cut away, obviously because he couldn't chew the crust very easily. A little mayonnaise, not a lot. A little mayonnaise, small pieces of lettuce. He had no teeth to handle larger pieces. Served with chips and an occasional cup of coffee before he departed for Atlanta. And it's important to note here that when he came up to my home on Park Drive, which is north of Alpharetta, he was living in Douglasville. So he made the trek down 20 to 285 all the way up 400, and he did this several times a week on a regular basis. And that was a very, very wonderful experience. We started off with the idea that we were going to have a printer up in, I think it was either Maryland or Virginia, and we were going to upload all of the entire book, have it uploaded and printed with offset lithography at that time. All the communication broke down with the printer. It was very hard for me to access the technical group that was up there, and furthermore, when Bill got the estimate of what it was going to have cost to have it printed, he balked a little bit. He didn't want to go that route, even though the proofs that I had received via FedEx were really wonderful. It was a very wonderful set of proofs to look at, but he just didn't want to go in that direction because of the cost. And I found it very difficult to deal with the particular printer that had been recommended. It was just a communication problem that was very, very difficult. So what I did is I went out and I think I'm having a difficult time remembering the name of the gentleman who ran the company, but it was the same printer that printed the legacy book for ACA at the time. The last semester ACA was in business. Yes, Ross Butler is his name, and is a very wonderful person, just a really wonderful person. And we had a very good dialogue with him. At the time, he had a Epson laser printer and a full bindery in his shop, which is located in Cumming, Georgia. I took Bill up there to meet him. We went through all of the procedures of having proofs done. There were some critical parts of the book that had to do with color theory that I impressed on Ross that Bill had to be okay with before they ran the print. Everything worked out on that. We got it published. Then Ross disappeared. I don't know where Ross is. The business went down the tubes. He invested money in a very large new laser printer, and I have a feeling that might have been one of the reasons why the business caved in. So there we were in a situation where if we wanted to do it again, we'd have to go find another printer. Interestingly enough, there was a criticism rendered of my design of the book, which I actually rebutted. I didn't particularly think the criticism was a valid criticism, and I didn't hear a lot of other people say that my design in any particular way was that bad. It had to do with the gutter. And I've seen a lot of books and a lot of really well-designed books that had gutters that were equal to the one I had in my book design. So I held to that. Nevertheless, I took the criticism into consideration and redesigned the book because Bill's daughter, Victoria, are you here?
No.
Bill, correct me if I'm wrong. It was my understanding that you wanted your father to have a hardbound copy of that book made. Is that correct?
I had asked.
Okay, so I took that to heart and went back to the computer with the help of Andrew Erickson, who is one of the very best students that came out of Peter Wong's program. And Andrew and I sat down. Is he here? Yeah. We sat down, and Andrew gave me some wonderful feedback on how we could not only change the design to a hardback book, but to improve some of the entries into the paragraph, into the chapters, with some interesting uses of the symbol of the hand. And I completed all that. I even took that to a printer that I found that was about within 20 minutes of where I live. That was kind of lucky. A place called Book Logic. And Book Logic was in a position where they could collaborate with the National Bindery, which was located in Roswell, Georgia, and I was ready to go. I even got estimates to proceed with the hardback version of the book. It's still in my computer, folks. And when I got the quotes, Bill walked on that. Anyway, I don't even think Andrew has seen the final copy of what we collaborated on.
I'll be running out of recording space. We need other people to be able to.
Okay, see, I am on with it. Okay.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
You look like Tommy Chong.
Oh, okay. All right. There's a time constraint here, so I'm going to end it. I'm going to just hit the highlights of the others. The other thing that's very interesting to note about Bill Nolan is his astuteness with regard to being able to take his cartoon illustration talent and put it to work. And that was with the book, and I can talk to you individually about this. It's a book called A Modern's Guide to Modern Metaphysics, written by Robert Soloway. That book hasn't been published because Robert Soloway himself fell on hard times. He went off to California. We lost complete touch with him. I have that book in my computer, and I also have a copy, just a spiral-bound copy for all of you to look at, and I can tell you some of the experiences that we had with this one.
Thank you so much.